and Kate Smith singing God Bless America. This is BBS Radio. The show is Sound Health, and I'm your host, Sherry Edwards. On this show, we attempt to bring you ideas and information that make your life a little easier, a lot freer, and help you move toward that responsibility of self-health and self-responsibility. As many of you know, I run a research institute, the Institute of Bioacoustic Biology. We do research dealing with vocal profiling, and it's a way for us to help you determine the biomarkers of health and wellness. We're now running a project on insulin resistance, and we've had incredible success with our pilot project. We were able to control glucose and insulin, and we used infrared sound. France is on its way to dealing with health in this issue, or in this way. America is just so far behind the rest of the world in health and economics, and we're supposed to be first. We're supposed to be the first in freedom, but all of our freedoms are absolutely being eroded. And what we do here at the center is try to look at health freedom and how that is being eroded. And on this show, we bring you people who help deal with all aspects of your freedom. You can get more information about that on our online journal, the Journal of Bioacoustic Biology, jbab.org. And I think you're going to love our guest today. He talks about freedom, freedom of mind, freedom of spirit. He gives information on how we can take back America. He will be joining us in just a moment. I have a couple of announcements. Not a lot of us know what we want individually, what we want in our own family, what we want in our community. And we tend to leave national issues to others. And from the looks of how the country is being run today, or I should say manipulated, that was a big mistake on our part. And we're doing our best here to support Ron Paul. I think this is going to be one of the most unusual elections ever had, and I'm going to ask our guest about that today. Some of you, when our guest, Eli Miller, was scheduled to be here before, sent us some wonderful questions, so we're going to ask him those questions. But first, Eli, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Sherry. It's my pleasure.
And you are the author of a series of wonderful manuscripts using this idea that time is now. You know, there's a lot of us don't have enough time. Thank you for your time to come to the show. But what do you mean by the time is now?
Well, I published my first manuscript in December of 1979 entitled The Time Is Now. Some almost 11 years later, in late 1990, I published a modification of that same manuscript entitled The Time Is Still Now. And in December of 2001, I wrote a third manuscript and published it called The Time Was or Is Still Now. My effort over the last 30 years is to bring attention to the citizens of our country to recall certain aspects of American history that are still tangible to our generation, dating back, starting with Vietnam, the Iranian crisis, if you will, or should I say Watergate, then the Iranian crisis, and then the Gulf War matter in the 1990-91, and then finally a few weeks after 9/11, to bring attention to not only how history repeats itself, but more particularly, what are the signals or the signposts, if you will, that indicate that our society is changing? And the question, of course, is it changing to the comfort and prosperity of our citizens, or is it changing in a direction that is contrary to those objectives? And starting at least 30 years ago, my inclination and feeling was that it was changing to the demise of our citizens, to the demise of freedom, and that in the future we would be subjected not only to higher taxation, but to less independence, having our ability to make intelligent choices compromised by a number of factors, most particularly evolving around the corporate structure and evolving around our inclination as a culture to go along with the status quo, feeling that either our vote or our point of view does not count, that we're helplessly attached and codependent upon privileges and benefits that in the end do not serve either ourselves or our children well. And unfortunately, I believe that I've been right. Nothing would please me more to have been wrong starting 30 years ago, but in reading what I have written over the years, it appears that I'm unfortunately right, and that we're facing a real calamity, if you will. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of indicators that would point to our society is in a significant status of decline in a number of different areas. Our institutions are that we became dependent upon and had faith in following World War II are beginning to fracture, falter, not live up to their promises, if you will. And we find our confidence in our government, in our elected officials, down to such lows that most societies have incurred revolution long before they've reached the demise and the sadness of our faith in our government and our institutions. The thing I think that has prevented us from going into a revolutionary era, if you will, has been our dependence upon benefits and privileges, and we've maxed those intentions to such a point now that they're failing all around us, be it medical care, medical insurance, the benefits that we can eke out of using our Social Security number, if you will. We've slowly but surely discovering that corporations are not obligated to the citizenry of the countries that they inhabit, that they use them, spit them out, dispose of them, all in the name of greed or profits. And so it brings us to a point in history of questioning what are our principles, what are our values, and not only defining them or redefining them, but investing in them so that in the years to come, we truly have a restructured backbone, and that we're not so adrift on the open seas at the whims of big business, of politicians who don't keep their promises or their assertions, and we're facing a major time in history these last 20, 30 years, and the next 10 or 20 do not look all that optimistic for the welfare and health of our country, literally and figuratively speaking.
Do you think this is the worst it's ever been in our history?
Well, it's hard to make that determination because we haven't been alive for 200 years. Monday morning quarterbacking, rear view appearances are always subject to the skewed perceptions, but here we have probably more at stake, if you will, than at any time in history. Money-wise, I mean, no time in history has our country ever been $9 trillion in debt. Nowhere in our history has our military complex been as stressed and as incapable of maintaining a military theater of any kind. And nowhere in our history have so many people been so dependent upon fictions, upon benefits and privileges as we are at this juncture. I don't think few times in American history have we've been individuals have had more debt than they've had savings or assets. And we see, of course, with the mortgage crisis, how one of our fundamental assets that we can pass on to our children and preserve for the benefit of our elders are being just usurped right out from under our eyes. Hundreds of billions of dollars have just vanished in less than 12 months right before our eyes. And at the same time, staples, commodities that we've become really dependent upon, of course, like petroleum, for example, and you know, some of our food commodities are beginning to reflect not only the depreciation of our dollar, of our currency, but also reflect more of a world of value than, shall we say, the special treatment that our country has enjoyed now for many decades. So we're certainly past the World War II baby boomer phenomena that certainly has been historical in any society. The question is, where do we go from here? What are our choices, and what can individual people do?
I have about 1,000 questions for you. One, where can people get your manuscripts?
I beg your pardon?
Where can people get your manuscripts? How do they get in touch with you?
Our website is thetimeisnow.us. That's www.thetimeisnow.us. There, all three manuscripts that I've published over the years are there, as well as the services that our organization provides in terms of asset protection, estate planning, and most importantly, how do we unvolunteer from what we volunteer into, such as, for example, Social Security.
Awesome. There's so many complaints about that and fears. I want to ask you a series of questions. What do you think other countries think about freedom in America?
Well, the word freedom in America is like love in America, to me at least, because it's frequently misunderstood and abused, certainly by this administration. In terms of how we reacted after 9/11. Those who are not in favor of freedom are against us, I believe, the executive branch pronounced after 9/11. To me, freedom is, the question is, how is freedom created? How is it nurtured? It's like fruit on a tree, if you will. It comes about, in my judgment, from learning how to live accountably. People who are able to be accountable in their word, in their deed, in their commerce, in how they relate to the planet and how they relate to others on this planet, entitle people. Entitle is not really the best word to use, but from that discipline of remaining accountable to ourselves, to our children, and to the world around us, produces freedoms that should not be abused, should not be taken for granted, should be revered, should be preserved, and should be protected. Whereas the word freedom, as it's more often than not used in our society, refers to freedom of activity or freedom of in the things that we're able to abuse or to pursue. That's not exactly my definition, and it's not the definition that I think our forefathers envisioned when they established a republic. But when we chase benefits or privileges through, for example, exploiting the Social Security number, get entranced with other things that the world of benefits and privileges seem to provide, on the front end, it's like a child who asks his mother if he can have a cookie before dinner. His mother says, no, not until after dinner. Well, is that limiting the child's freedom, or is it preserving the child's freedom? At what point in time does common sense discipline enhance and preserve freedom and not inhibit it? Rules and regulations, as we begin to experience after 9/11, appear to inhibit the freedom of activity and choice that we had prior to 9/11. But more importantly, what are we doing with our children? What are we doing with public policy? What are we mandating or requiring our government officials to do, besides adding more laws to the books, more rules and regulations to the books? What are we doing in order to develop that fruit called freedom? I don't see a whole lot of it. Where there are sectors of our society that appear to live or pursue a life of accountability, we find them under fire or under stress, under criticism, and abuse, where we channel our attitudes against them, poke fun at them, and yet on the other hand, the people that do that are least righteous, if you will, in the process of things. So I think in part this is what's meant in the Bible when it says the meek shall inherit the earth. The meek usually don't expect a lot. They may pray and hope for more, but they learn how to live with less. They're respectful, they're reverent, they have respect for life and life forms around them, and they represent, shall we say, the bottom, and everything on top of that is so at flux, so unreliable, that I'm not sure if we can really refer to that superfluous nature in our society as genuine freedom.
We teach classes here, and we have a lot of international students. They come here and they say, this is not a free country. We read some of your history and some of the things going on with your government now. Why don't you guys rebel? And many of them know more about our government than we do. For instance, this executive order that Bush put through a year ago March, giving him absolute power in a state of emergency to take over businesses, schools, corporations, anything. And Congress didn't stop him. Why not?
Well, I heard Lou Dobbs yesterday say that for every congressman and senator, there are 77 lobbyists. And there's over $4 billion annually that's spent on lobbying the very people that we put in office to protect our interests. You ask, why not? They no longer serve the people. Their primary interest is not the people. Their primary interest is jockeying between special interests. So if we continue to look to these usurpers to protect us, we find that they're really the last that we should look to protect us. Instead, we should look to ourselves and ask ourselves not only how dependent we become on these benefits and privileges that these bureaucrats have been handing out for decades, and to what extent they're all voluntary, they're not mandatory, to what extent are we capable either through faith, through self-confidence, through determinateness, through genetic memory. How capable are we from backing away, from unvolunteering from some of these things, so that we too can get closer to the meek, if you will, and have reverence for life? You speak to, you know, executive orders that give the executive branch, you know, privilege or opportunity to take over this, to take over that, if they see fit. Indeed, this is preemptory to things yet to come, and these things will occur in the future, you can be assured. 9/11 will not be the last time that there is an attack on our homeland, or that fear is circulated amongst the populace in order for them to conform, to go along, to approve of even more rules and regulations. There are societies out there, countries, if you will, that could be argued that they are indeed, shall we say, more free than the United States. They don't have as many rules and regulations. They have more common sense than rules. Their electorate is connected to the people at large better than ours is. They have a sense of morality, responsibility, self-respect that it seems like many of us in this country has lost. And so it could be argued that, you know, from those standpoints, they have more freedom. But I'm not sure what, you know, your students and the people that you're referring to actually mean when they talk about freedoms.
One of the things, in a lot of other countries, there are videos being shown about, and even on YouTube, that people have testified that they helped rig election machines, yet nothing's being done about it. Even if we wanted to vote these people out, we can't, because we feel they're rigged. The whole elections process is just a joke.
And that's why the future is bleak. It doesn't appear that we're headed down a course, I believe, where we're staring some type of civil war, domestic civil unrest, straight in the face. If oil prices, for example, continue to rise, we could see millions and millions of people homeless, walking the freeways instead of driving them. We could see food lines in a depression that would make 1929 look like child's play. We're right on the border of these things. And possibly this is where we need to go before we're able to really turn around and break through the enigma, the malaise, that has become so prevalent in our society. When you consider that, for example, we're a society of some 300 million people, and yet in a general election, it will be hard to muster up more than maybe 50, 60 million of those people voting at best, that does not bode well with a society that boasts of being the example to the world of democracy, rigging voting machines, making that the majority of the citizens voting does not count. Doesn't make any difference whether you get the majority of votes anymore in America. There's always some other scheme to usurp that away. We're a society in decline. I think few would argue with that. The question is, where is the bottom? When are we going to turn around? When are we going to insist that the scoundrels, the special interests, the $4 billion a year that's pounded away or spent inside the Beltway stops? We have a candidate in Obama, for example, that promises change. I'm not able to see the structure of his change, other than some beautiful rhetoric that can energize folks. That's great. That'll get us at least to the stadium. and will have a lap full of popcorn and soda to begin the game, but I'm not sure if in itself it's enough to get us through the process of really restructuring our society when it has become so dependent upon benefits and privileges and the structure of special interests.
What do you think of this political situation that's going on right now?
Well, you mean...
candidates, presidential, the censorship of Ron Paul, the fight between Obama and Hillary, which is obvious. Sniping.
Yeah, again, I can't help but smile in some accord with Jesse Ventura and others who say we don't really have much of a choice. Where are the choices? Where are the ballots that say none of the above, for example, as Mr. Ventura has asked? Isn't it at least modestly remarkable that after hundreds of millions of dollars in the Democratic primary, that the best that the Democratic primary or the Democratic Party can surface is a man who's got only 2 years of experience, who has not authored and passed any particular bill to demonstrate his commitment to the populace, who, although has great rhetoric, there are hundreds of people, good people in government, that have experience, honesty, dedication, and their lives out on the front table way beyond this man. And yet, other than for rhetoric, this is the best that the Democratic Party can put forth as a candidate at this time of crisis in our country. He's a man who's got barely 2 years of experience in the Senate.
It means we're stuck with McCain and 4 years of the same old, same old.
Well, it was in February, immediately after McCain won North Carolina, shall we say. And my press release said 8 more years of Bush. That was the title of my press release. This was at least weeks before the Democrats picked up on, well, if you vote for McCain, you're voting for another term of George Bush. Weeks before that consciousness came out in the public sector. And in that press release, I projected that McCain would become our next president. And most likely he will choose Mitt Romney as his running mate. And that the economy will not be issue number one in November, but that fear as a result of some type of further military conflict in the world will resurface long before November that will keep McCain front and center. But in February, I projected that he would become our next president.
What do you think happened in this election with Ron Paul and the media just absolutely banning him when he's the people's candidate and raised more money than others? And what happened? How is our media allowed to censor that kind of thing?
Well, what can any of us do about it? Our media is totally corporate. It's boiled down to two or three networks, Fox, CNN. And if you throw NBC and ABC in there, you might come up with a half of the impact that the cables are having on society. Reporting, true news reporting, investigative reporting, has metamorphized into something completely different, a la Fox and CNN. And this election, in my judgment, you asked the question, what do you think about the candidates in the election process as we sit here in the first week of June of 2008, it has been totally contrived, so obviously contrived by the networks, by the media. Ron Paul 20 years ago would have gotten a far better play with his principles and with his positions than he did today. He was essentially, for the most part, anti-corporate, anti-big government, anti-Department of Education, anti-the Federal Reserve, and these are institutions that enable these mega corporations to do what they do and get away with what they're doing. So naturally, they would come out and with a significant bias against Mr. Paul. I unfortunately was in a position to help Mr. Paul early on, but didn't succeed in resonating with him. And as a consequence, I believe his campaign faltered.
I'm just appalled at what's going on, and from what you're saying, there's not much we can do about it.
There's each one of us. It's not so much an issue of what they should do, whoever they are, big business, corporations, the media, government that won't listen to the people. The question is, what can each of us do about it? And the most significant thing, and I've been preaching this now for nearly 30 years, but I believe and still strongly believe that the most significant thing that each one of us can do is to start cranking down the degree of how we rely upon benefits and privileges. Keep in mind that in December ending 1941, there were only 3.4 million Social Security numbers that had been issued. The program had been around for a little less than 3 years. It was not doing all that well. But by December ending 1945, there were more than 44 million Social Security numbers. And following World War II, we embarked upon this notion that we didn't call it big government then, we called it Uncle Sam, that Uncle Sam could help us better than we could help ourselves. And so we began investing in this scheme called Social Security. Today, 60 years later, there's barely 1 in 100,000, if not even more than 100,000, that knows what to do and how to live without that number. We become totally dependent upon it. Our house is connected to it, a property, our health care, our income, our food and our automobiles and clothes and everything is connected to that Social Security number. And we find ourselves with far less equity in our property, far less savings in our family accounts, far less ability to do anything about anything today than we did before we started using that number. Because we bought into this notion that they, or Uncle Sam, or government, can help us better than we can help ourselves. We've got to change that notion. We've got to get back to the belief and the confidence that we are our own best resource, that unless we know how to take care of ourselves, we can't expect somebody else to bear that burden. It's our responsibility. Our health, our education, the future of our children, what we choose to invest in, minimize how much we chase benefits and privileges. And in addition to that, we've adopted a new definary in our society. The English language has roughly plus or minus roughly 1.2, 1.3 million words in it. You knock out 200,000-300,000, maybe a few more for technical terms, but essentially we have a million words. Well, many of those words, there's a core of that of our language that has been around for hundreds, if not arguably, certainly many hundreds of years, and there are definitions to words that should not have changed, but they have. I mean, for example, we don't understand why the word marriage is prohibited from being used in the ceremony. The ceremony doesn't go to, you take this man to be your legally married husband. That's not the covenant. No. But we think that the word marriage And wed is the same. We think the words lawful and legal are the same. They're not. We think rights and freedoms are the same. They're not. We think there's a lot of things. I mean, you pick up the phone, you call the 800 number behind your credit card because you have a question about your card or your account, and you get a recording that says, "Just one moment, please. A banker will be with you." And you say, "A banker will be with me in just a moment." You open the dictionary, and the definition of a banker is one who owns a bank. Wait a minute. You think the owner of the bank is going to get on my 800 telephone call and talk to me? No, it's going to be a hired clerk or technician or someone else, but not a banker. But we've lost sense of our definary of our words that have guided us, that have protected us, and that have preserved our freedoms. And we start abusing these words, giving them other definitions based upon, you know, the sign of our times, if you will. Today love means this, or today legal means this. Well, wait a minute, hold it. When do we put a stop to these fads and to these fantasies and stay the course with things that we know that do work? And and our culture and our generation pays little or no attention to that, and they're all out. Rather than focusing on quality in manufacturing or quality in terms of importing products, we're in the process of whatever makes money is okay. Whatever is good for the economy is okay. Well, that's not true. It's not true relative to the environment. It's not true relative to our health. It's not true relative to our education. Those principles are shallow, they're short-lived, and the backlash has a very, very vicious and dangerous bite to them that we as a nation are beginning to feel.
How can people opt out of Social Security and taxes? How do they do that?
Well, a good question. And keep in mind that Social Security is 100% voluntary. Now, I'm sure that some of your listeners would disagree with that, but I invite them to contact Social Security Administration and obtain from them a brochure that is circulated to mothers of newborn children. It's a question and answer brochure. It was originally designed in 1946, I believe, 47, and it hasn't changed other than the cover to it over the years. The second question in the brochure says, must my baby get a Social Security number? The answer is no. Getting your baby a Social Security number is strictly voluntary. And the words strictly voluntary are in bold. And indeed, our grandparents, being suspicious in the 30s about this program, said, "We'll go along with this program under one proviso, that you tell our children and our grandchildren, our great-great-grandchildren, participation in this program is voluntary." That was very, very important to our grandparents. And so it's part of the primary law. But today, what difference does that information make to most people? All right, because everywhere they go, they ask for the Social Security number. What are they going to do? Well, wait a minute. Let's see. Well, our parents lived up through 1945, or at least 1940, without the number. They provided food, shelter, homes, income for their families and whatnot, without having the welfare state that we do today. Without that number, so they were able to live. The question is, how can we live today without that number? We need to change, here again, come back to definaries. If we're going to pursue jobs, there's no way in the world that we can get a job without some kind of a tax identification number. But what happened to work? Why don't we as a society focus on what are we going to do in our work, in our profession, in that which we love and want to carry forward with comfort and assurance rather than for greed? And then all of a sudden we have to get off the track of jobs, which are privilege-based, and go to work, which happens to be a constitutional right. And so it's hard to tell our young children that, because they're out looking for, what, guess what, jobs. From privileges, corporations are 100% privileges, all right? They have to, they're unconstitutional. There's nothing in any of the constitutions of our land, not one of them, that talk about corporations, because corporations are part of the privileged class, and constitutions were put as guidelines or restrictions that wanted to steer society away from privileged class and more toward equality, one man, one vote.
What happens?
So if we continue to go to the drug dealer, to the unlawful activity, which corporations are, and ask them for benefits, such as a job, well, then we've got to play their game, whatever their game is. If we want to buy into their so-called teasers or carrots and say, well, if you come aboard, you're going to get health care, you're going to get pension, you're going to get all these other things, we fail to realize that in actuality, they're under no obligation. And of course, the events over the last decade have more than adequately proven this. They're under no obligation to keep those promises or those assurances to the citizens of any country.
Okay, so how do we get out of having a Social Security number if we don't have to get in for our babies, but we can't get a job without one because they come? And we have a question from the audience, too, about this. How do we do that?
Well, first of all, we can stop participating in the fraud. In June of 2004, plus or minus a month, the Treasury Department, one of the rare few times that it ever has, just prior to the last national election, came out and admitted that for December ending 2003, that the Internal Revenue Service obtained nearly $94 billion worth of revenue from the marriage penalty tax. Well, to most people, they listen to that and they go, what do you mean, $94 billion for the marriage penalty tax? Is there a penalty tax for marriage? And every election, you'll hear a few bozos out there going, oh, I think this marriage penalty tax is wrong. If you vote for me, I'll work to repeal that. Well, it can't be repealed unless you're going to repeal the Constitution. It's impossible to repeal it because a marriage license is permission to do unlawful acts. At the end of World War I, I believe there were only four states in the Union that even permitted marriage licenses. At the end of World War II, I think there were only 11, maybe as much as 14, but not anymore, states at the end of World War II that permitted marriage licenses. Today, every state not only permits them, but mandates them, because they're essential component to our tax base. So, you know, people out there getting a marriage license, coming back to their accountant at the end of the year, their accountant says, well, are you, Jim and Jane, married? Yes, we're married. Well, then you file jointly. Well, my friend says that filing jointly costs us more than if we file separately. Well, but if you got married, you need to file jointly. But that's not, there's good news. Jane and Bill says, well, what is the good news? And the accountant says, well, the good news is that if you have a child, you'll be able to use that child as a deduction. They scratch their head and go, oh, wow. And if we have two children, well, then you get ahead of the game, the accountant says. You'll be able to deduct both of them. What the accountant is not telling you, in fact, is that for putting your children, giving them a Social Security number, using them as a deduction on your 1040, gives you a benefit for the first 18 years, plus or minus around $30,000 per child. However, the system expects from an 18-year-old to a 64-year-old between $1.3 and $1.7 million in tax revenue. So for a short-term gain of $30,000 for the parents per child, why, you're enslaving your child to a burden of debt of between $1.3 and $1.4 million? And you're asking me about freedom? When we deliberately enslave our children to a debt they are not responsible for, but that we and our parents are.
Is this what your company does?
Aren't any freedoms around? Is this, it sounds quite oxymoronic.
Yeah, is this what your company does? Help people get out of this?
Well, we begin with a consultation process to learn, first of all, how entrenched in the system are you? Is a family or a single? How entrenched? How dependent have you become? And what realistic options do you have of unvolunteering from that which you volunteered into? What options and choices do you have? If you've worked for the same company for 12 years and you're looking to retire in three more years and you've got a 401k and you've been paying your taxes and you've got a home and mortgage and so forth and you've got a half a dozen credit cards, your life is invested in these benefits and privileges. The question for your listening audience or for people is to ask themselves, at what point in time are they willing to walk away from these benefits and privileges so that at the end of the road they have something to show for what they work for all their lives? Because if they stay with that corporation, they won't. They'll be out on the street in 3 years. If they're continuing to look for their 401k, they're missing the reality that corporations are walking away from commitments and pension funds, and 401ks are being abused, and nobody knows what their 401k money is going to. How is it being invested? Excuse me.
So this issue is about these government and corporations think we're too stupid to handle our own affairs.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, when you consider how life insurance got going in this country 100 years ago, got going on the principle that people couldn't save a dollar a month. And so Metropolitan and New York Life had programs where you paid a dollar a month for a $5,000 life insurance policy. People would pay a dollar a month, but they couldn't save a dollar a month. That created mega corporations, hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars. Not just that one principle that people couldn't save a dollar a month. That was learned by the corporate structure in our society 100 years ago. So yes, of course. I mean, a corporation's profit bottom line is dependent upon how slick they can manipulate the minds of the populace to buy or chase their products or their fads so that they can come in quickly and go out quickly with profit. And in terms of accountability, you couldn't find it with a microscope or a magnifying glass.
I think at least our listeners and VBS listeners are beginning to get it. Here is an email that came in. Seems to me that the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting dirt poor. Is there any way to stop this? I feel like I'm getting taxed from every direction. I'm a small business owner, and it seems to me that I'm supporting a broke economy locally by having to pay for those on welfare with an extra 6% tax, state taxes, income taxes, employment taxes, property taxes, gas taxes, and taxes on my taxes. Tell me how to opt out.
Well, first of all, I could answer your question globally here, but one of the key answers to the question is one needs to examine the nexus of possession, of ownership. If that small business owner would drop the word owner, just that one word, owner, the perception that it's his business, for example, then he could completely rearrange his tax liability virtually overnight. For example, frequently I'm given business cards by businessmen, people who have their own companies. And a typical example is Jim Jones, and I won't use that name, Jim Smith, president of Smith Industries on Smith Drive. And I look at that business card and I smile and I say, oh my goodness, you volunteered in the highest tax bracket our country has to offer. And every single time, their eyes will about drop out of their head and they'll say, how do you know I'm paying a lot in taxes? And I say, well, it says so right here on your business card. And they go, what do you mean? And I says, well, you've got to have everything in your name. Otherwise, you can't control it. Is that correct, Mr. Smith?
Well, yes.
Well, that's your problem. Because you see, taxes that were essentially evolved from Babylonia some 3,400 years ago or more haven't changed an iota to this day. Taxes inure for two basic reasons in society. That's certainly true here in America. The number one tax-generating nexus is unlawful activity. That means activity that is contrary to the common law, to the constitution of the land, or to God's law, if for lack of better words, if you will. The second thing is greed. And greed in our country is defined and identified by ownership. If you don't own it, you can't be taxed as an owner. Well, people scratch their head and say, well, if I don't own it, well, that is, you know, I thought here in America I could own it. Yes, you can. But in doing so, you've fallen into the clutches of the Internal Revenue Service and the design of obtaining tax revenue based upon your greed, defined as ownership.
Eli?
If on the other hand, that business is put into a trust and the man's wife or children or grandchildren are identified as the beneficiaries, then that's going to change the tax structure in that business dramatically.
Eli, we're out of time. Can you tell people, answer, do they need to see you individually or do you do workshops?
No, we perform our consultations over the phone, but they can contact us through www.thetimeisnow.us, and we have an 800 number there that we can be contacted also. Inquiries can fill out a modest name and best time to reach. And we begin with a consultation to look at what people's comfort zones are, what they can or shouldn't do, what they can expect for backing away, downsizing, and otherwise diminishing their reliance upon the Social Security system.
And you do this for businesses as well as individuals?
Yes, we're very involved with business reorganizations, both small and large. We have offshore offices in which we can provide solutions for the appropriate clients, in those areas as well.
Okay, and we will list on the description of the show your contact numbers too. Thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you, Sherry, for having me.
I think it's a great alarm that you've sounded to society. I encourage everyone to go to this website and look at these manuscripts. There's a lot of information, step by step, and get in touch with Eli. And let's take back our country.
Thank you for having me, Sherry.
We'll take back our country.
Bye bye.
Be an American. Where at least I know I'm free. But I won't forget the men who died, who gave that right to me. And I'm glad to stand up next to you and defend her still today. 'Cause there ain't no doubt I love this land.